Hello, Internet. Welcome to episode 43 of the Assorted Calibers podcast. The Second Amendment podcast is a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard, and with me, as always, is my lovely and road-weary hostess, Aaron Paulette. How are you doing, Aaron?
I am fried with a capital I. Oh my god, I'm tired. Okay, you probably know this, but what the heck? I live in Florida, East Coast,
East Side!
And, for the past five days, I have been in Utah, which is Mountain Time Zone. That's a long way away. So, when I left Wednesday morning, it was 13 hours to get there. And at this point, I'm not even sure if that's like 10 hours of flying plus the 3 hours for the time zones or 13 and then the three. I don't know. I'm not mathing. And then I had a wonderful time at Life, the Universe, and Everything, which we'll talk about in just a moment. And then, so the convention ended Saturday because it's hosted by Mormons, who are lovely people, but for the most part, they don't do anything on Sunday. They really adhere to that Sabbath day of rest thing. And so Sunday, I just kind of chilled out, and I packed my stuff, and there was a possibility I would meet with people, but it didn't happen. But the only flight I could get out was 12:30 in the morning on Monday.
Wait, as in midnight?
Yes, as in half past midnight.
Oh, dark 30, literally.
Well, I mean, that's not that bad for me. My normal sleep cycle is, I usually get tired at about 2 a.m. And so, hey, look, I'm in Utah. I'm starting to get tired around midnight. That worked out really well. So I was a little bit tired, but it wasn't too bad, and I dozed a little bit on the flight. But still, no one really gets quality rest on an airplane. And it was like, you know, 8 hours or so back. And other than whatever I got on the plane, you know, I hadn't slept for about 24 hours by the time I arrived in Florida. And let's see, Utah was snowing when I left. Not snowing hard, but I'm a Floridian. I don't comprehend stuff falling from the sky that isn't thawed. I mean, you know, we flirt with freezing temperatures, but when stuff actually freezes from the sky, I don't know how to deal with this. And then we flew back here, and then it's like 80 degrees and 70% humidity, and I'm having to rely on the vestigial gills again. And, I'm babbling. I am really, really toasty. So, hey, listeners, this is going to be one of your tired Aaron without filters, episodes. I've listened to the episodes, the segments, the whatevers. I don't know if I could remember a thing about them. So, hey, I am gonna half-ass this mofo. what do you want to know, Weird? How you doing? How you doing?
Let's talk about your convention. I want to know because I've seen some of the pictures. I've heard a few of the stories.
Okay. So I was invited to be on three panels, one each day, conveniently. The first one was Fundamentals of Self-Defense Law, featuring myself, Law Dog, and Old NFO. And I'm just going, what the hell am I doing here? I am not qualified. And it worked out because Law Dog has 20 years of practical experience as, I don't know if he's a sheriff or a police officer or one of those, but
he's a peace officer.
He does this for a living. Right. He's an amazing storyteller. Plus, stories just happen to him. This seems to be his superpower. I can't go into details because I don't know if he shared it publicly or not. But, I mean, on his flight into Salt Lake City, the man had an experience that was story-worthy. It's right up there with, like, Oleg's ability to summon beautiful women and make them get naked. It's just, that's his superpower. And then there's Old NFO, who I don't really know a lot about, but he, well, okay, when he describes himself as an old fart, I figure I can use that too. And so he's just got decades and decades of experience. And then you got me, Schmucky the Clown. So I brought to that panel just the energy of an enthusiast. And the moderator asked questions. And so NFO and Law Dog, they've got all this practical experience. And what can I do? Well, I kind of default to telling stories. And one of the questions was, what are the things you hate about how Hollywood handles guns? Because I guess we'd gotten, even though the panel was about self-defense law, we really didn't touch on the law thing. It was more like self-defense for writers. You know, it, okay, well, I got to back up a little bit. Life, the Universe, and Everything is a symposium. And the idea is that there are writers who want to learn more about a subject. And so they bring in experts or enthusiastic amateurs to talk about it so that the writers can ask questions and have a better understanding. This is awesome. I'm not really sure why it still exists when we've got the internet, but it's still cool. And so the question was, all right, well, what are the things that Hollywood does that you can't stand? And we had the typical, you know, you shoot someone and they go flying backwards 5 feet. Or how in TV and the movies, you can shoot someone and then everything's fine. You go have a drink and you don't have the shakes afterwards or soul searching or whatever. And then the question came to me, and okay, I could talk about how, you know, safety's on revolvers or pumping a shotgun for emphasis. But I go, no, it's kind of boring. And so I told a story, because that's what I do. And I said, so let me tell you about a show that I actually saw on TV, and I'll tell you what's wrong with it. And I started telling a story about an episode of Arrow, which is on the CW. It's their version of the Green Arrow character. It has since gone to crap. It was pretty good for the first 3 seasons. I think this one happened in season 4. And, all right, so the general premise is that a trailer of industrial diamonds was stolen. And Team Arrow investigates, and they're going, why would anyone want to steal industrial diamonds? They're not valuable like regular diamonds. As it turns out, the bad guys wanted to steal the diamonds so that they could put them in the hollow tips of bullets and use them in submachine guns so that they could raid a police station and shoot through police body armor, because, as we know, bullets are the hardest substance on Earth, and therefore they would penetrate police Kevlar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, so I tell it with a lot more emphasis and panache and other French words, and I've got the gesture, and just, you know, the audience is rapt, because even they know, wait, no, diamonds, because, you know, you shape diamonds, you fracture them with hammers, and they would break. And so the audience is just doing that, they didn't. Meanwhile, next to me, I am causing Law Dog actual physical pain. He starts off by banging his head on the table, and then he just ends with a double face palm. And I took some sort of perverse glee in just ruining him by telling him that story. And the moderator thought it was hilarious, because on the one hand, he's pro-gun. I don't know exactly how gunny he is. But on the other hand, the moderator can also understand the rule of awesome. And, okay, yeah, it's not realistic when someone gets hit with a shotgun at point-blank range and they fly back 5 feet. But it's awesome and it's cool, and therefore in his mind, it's okay. And so he was just torn between, that's stupid, but I love it.
Yeah, I one time saw, and I get the rule of awesome, I one time saw in a movie somebody running from somebody with a shotgun, and they touched off a round, and the person ran past some laundry hanging there, and I can't remember if it was towels or bed sheet, but when the shotgun blast nearly missed them, it looked like a 3-foot wad cutter had hit the laundry and just cut a perfect circle through that. And that is so stupid and also really awesome. I think it was a towel too, because there was shreds of terry cloth in the air. Like, it looked really cool. It was really emphatic. It was a well framed up shot. I saw what they did there. It isn't realistic, both on how much a shotgun spreads, and also, yeah, even if the shotgun was spreading that much, there's only 9 pellets in buckshot. It's not going to do that. But rule of awesome, yeah, sometimes awesome's okay.
Mm-hmm. So that was the sort of thing I talked about, whereas the other two fellows were very technical. I'm a writer. I don't have a lot of experience, but, you know, here's what annoys me, or here's the sensory thing. When I told my story about being at Big Three and the guy next to me ammo dumping, it look it up, or just things like that. And I just kind of did my own thing. And I was told by people who listened or who attended that that I did a good job. I was worried about nothing, so that was cool. Saturday, I was on a panel, how to repress a gender, race, or species, and I don't really have a whole lot to say. It was okay. It could have been better in some places. People who were there told me that I was the best part of the panel, and so thank you. By the way, all these panels were recorded by the LTUE staff. I don't know when they're going to put them up. When they go up on YouTube, I'll link to them.
Awesome.
And so Saturday was the big one. It was Warfare in the Age of Drones and Robots. And so, again, old NFO, you know, Navy guy, he knows about sensors, and I don't know that he probably has worked with drones, but if nothing else, it's his area of expertise. He keeps up on it. And of course, Larry Correa. And I figure half the audience is going to be there just to see Larry, because Larry is fun and funny and entertaining, and the man is huge.
He's a big dude.
Oh, okay, so here's this. Given both his height and his breadth, I expected like Lyle Alzado levels of, you know, I'm not talking like basso profundo, but, you know, I expected some degree of, you know, very macho masculine, and his voice is about like yours.
Yeah.
And the thing is, your voice matches your build. It does not match his. It's like he's six, I don't know what, 6 foot six. He's like 3 or 4 feet wide. He's massive, and he's like a baritone. Mm-hmm. It's like, wow, huh? But I mean, he's just an absolute sweetheart. We actually had to call him over to the table because he was just chatting up with fans. He's just a really friendly guy. He came over and he recognized me, and he talked to me by name. The International Lord of Hate knew who I was. He recognized me. He called me by... That's so cool! And I handed him an Operation Blazing Sword t-shirt, and he was thrilled, and he held it up, and there's pictures of him holding it up in front of him and just grinning like a loon. He loves it. And we gave a good panel. The two fellas plus the moderator, Cal Briggs, I think. Cal is a Gulf War veteran. He's done work with drones. I mean, you know, we had two actual subject matter experts plus a storyteller there, and then there's me who is just, hi, I don't know much. I just think drones are really cool. I study on them. I was able to actually bring some things to the table, a couple of historical things, and so friends told me later, you know, when you were talking about such and such, old NFO was just nodding along with you, and so, oh, cool, I actually got some things right. But really, really, the main part of that panel is that I got along with Larry, and it was really cool, and at the end, we took a picture, and... Well, Weird, you know me. You know that I am just this gigantic canned ham.
Yes.
And I have played verbally with Larry before because, you know, people say he's this, you know, Hady McHaterson. It's how he got the nickname International Lord of Hate, because the perception, yes, which is untrue. Mm-hmm. I don't want to accidentally slander the man, but people claim because he's a gun owner, is that, you know, he hates all non-white people and he hates queer people and all these other things. And I just said, you know, we should absolutely get a picture of me really, like, uncomfortably close to you. And so here's a picture of the, you know, quote unquote, you know, racist, hateful Larry Correa, end quote, next to a trans woman. And he's going, yeah, that'd be great. I'm all for it. And so we took the group picture, and I just decided, you know what, let's be funny. And because I'm right next to him, and I just drop to my knees, and I kind of do that classic Frank Frazetta pose, because, I mean, you know, he's big, and I'm just kind of there, you know, my head, like, at his thigh. And so I actually thought about grabbing him, but I didn't, for two reasons. Because first of all, Mrs. Correa was in the audience, and I'm certainly not going to sexually assault the International Lord of Hate, especially with his wife in the room. She'll kill me. And, you know, it would be rude and all that other stuff. But I did get her permission just to kind of ham it up, and so I just sort of have my hands up in sort of a worshipful pose, like, oh my God, Larry, you are just so big and so magnificent.
Which, by the way, I believe this is going to be that him and his wife is going to be the cover for Target Rich Environment 2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did a version of that. And Larry has some sort of weird pose. It almost looks like he's dabbing, but not quite. It's hilarious. And then, of course, you've got the rest of, well, you've got old NFO and then a couple of friends of mine, Jared and Jaweerden. If I say it wrong, I'm so sorry. It's Dutch. And fellow BCP contributor, Loki Dude, and maybe someone else. I don't think Cal was in the picture. I don't know. Anyway, so there are like three people looking kind of normal, and then there were we two oddballs at the end just completely hamming it up. It was great. And then later I got a picture of just, you know, Larry's arm around me, and, you know, I'm up against him, and it's really cute. And I've got all these pictures on my Facebook page, and it's awesome. I had a great time. I met a lot of cool people, made some friends, got to meet some people that I've only known online, got to meet them in person. And of course, I spread the word about Operation Blazing Sword everywhere I could. You know, that made it a business trip, because I couldn't have done this just for fan stuff. I had to actually be there in my role as OBS director, which is one of the reasons why I was on the panel about oppression. I should probably talk about that a little. So it was essentially, all right, well, so you're writing a story that has an evil empire and things like that, and so this is how you oppress people, and then, all right, now that you figured out how to oppress a certain group, here's how you would build a rebellion. And I felt really icky about it, because I actually recommended Rules for Radicals by Saul Alinsky. And, yeah, I don't like his politics, but honestly, if you're looking for source material on how to overthrow a government, that's kind of what the book is about. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah. So I have rambled all over the place. Weird. I have, in fact, bukkakeed all over this podcast with my rambling.
Well, I will take this moment to seize the mic and talk about my travels, because of course, those of you who are listening to the regular podcast, you will note that, yeah, we were absent last week, and we mentioned it in the previous week's podcast. The Patreon patrons, they got themselves a nice bonus show, which I'm already hearing happy responses to. So
bonus show featuring duck vagina.
Yes. Yes, it is. It was just a happy miracle, as I was wringing my hands, because for the patrons, I want to make sure they paid for the whole month. I want to make sure they get the whole month. And when we take a week off, yeah, that's kind of a little hole. And, you know, I guess
just like a duck vagina.
Oh, boy. And so I'm just like, well, what are we going to do to make this right for those people that are going to have that missing spot? And they weren't kind enough to give us money. And, just so happened that, we got talking about duck vagina as a culinary thing. And, Connie, from, Washington Plain English just happened to walk into the chat room at the exact right time. And, we created a whole show out of it. So I hope you all enjoyed that. But yeah, I went to Disney World with my family, and unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to see you, Aaron, when I was down there. I gave it some thought, but I don't know how other people do Disney vacations, but I've gone to Disney multiple times. My first time when I was seven, and every single time it has been slam, slam, slam. You can never see everything unless maybe you took like 2 weeks. And there, you can't see everything at these parks. There's so much stuff, and not even like, okay, I don't like that. I'm not interested in getting my picture taken with Cinderella, so I'm gonna skip Cinderella. No, you can skip all the stuff that you know you're not interested in, and still not see everything in the Disney World parks, especially now that they keep opening up new parks. And so, yeah, I was just like, yeah, Aaron, I don't know if we're going to be able to get away from this, because we're just going back and forth. And of course, we were also going until my daughter starts getting glassy eyed. And I'm like, all right, we got to beat a hasty retreat to the hotel room and get her in bed, get her a little bit of a nap time, and then back to the parks. So we had a great time while we were in Disney. The weather was, for Florida, terrible. It was it was cold and rainy for most of it, which overall it wasn't all that bad. And again, when you leave Massachusetts in February, the worst weather Central Florida can throw at you is pretty nice.
Yeah, it's like when I left, I think it was 60 degrees here. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what it was up in Massachusetts, but, well, freezing to 60 degrees is balmy.
Yes. Our coldest time was at one point, it was in the low 50s.
It was
chilly. My wife actually went into a gift shop and bought a sweatshirt. She's like, yeah, I need to throw some money at this problem. But meanwhile, we were collecting snow in our yard. And so we spent a couple of days there, and every year we go and visit my wife's father, who lives in Fort Myers. And so we spent 4 days in Disney, and then spent a couple of days with my father-in-law in Fort Myers. And when we got to Fort Myers, the weather was exactly what expected. It was high 70s, low 80s, clear skies, not bad humidity. It was wonderful. And so, like, I was swimming in the pool with my daughter every single day. And on Sunday, which was the day we flew back, we got up at dawn and drove to a beach in Fort Myers. So we would beat the crowds, and we're morning people. We do such things. And my daughter and I were swimming with dolphins.
Oh, cool.
Off the beach. Yeah. 2 years in a row, the same beach. There's been a pod of dolphins fishing on the beach early in the morning. And my daughter was, I'm a marine biologist. I was super excited by it. They were porpoising, so that was even cool, seeing them jump all the way out of the water. That was awesome. And so, yeah, swimming with dolphins in the ocean, you know, in wonderful, you know, 70 degree weather. And it's been snowing all day today. I got on a plane and came home to 20 degrees. And then I got up at 3 o'clock this morning and used the bathroom. And I could tell just by looking at the color of the light coming through the shades that the street lights are getting a whole lot more reflection back off of them. The street is not black right now, is it? And lifted up the shade, and oh no, it is very white out. And had to break out the shovel first thing in the morning. So
yeah, we both experienced 40 degree temperature differentials.
Oh boy. It just, the vastness of this country, that you could go from the soggy subtropical Florida to the desert and have it be chilly and snowing. And me going from 80-degree weather and I'm swimming in the ocean, too. If I fell in the ocean, if they didn't fish me out in 15 minutes, I would die. Literally.
Mountains. Okay, Florida is flat. I mean, we occasionally have little hills, but it's pretty much flat, okay? I go to Provo, and there are mountains on at least two sides. Mm-hmm. And
not little mountains either.
No, these mountains are so, okay, they were actually freaking me out. And I don't mean like phobia or whatever, but something similar to vertigo, but not really. Because here's the thing. The mountains were so freaking huge that based on perspective, it looked like they were two blocks away. Mm-hmm. It's like I'm looking down the street, block. I think that's where the mountain begins. And it was just so big and immediate and there and looming. And it kind of gave me the feeling that it was going to fall on me because it was so big and so close. And I knew that it wasn't, but it was just that feeling of, oh my God, it is looming. And I couldn't really deal with the feeling of there's a mountain two blocks away. It was just really, really intense. Woo!
Oh, but yeah, it's a big country.
Yeah.
All of that without needing a passport.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to touch a little bit on for our current event. It's a little stale as we're recording this, and the listeners are hearing this even later. But I read about this when I first got on getting on the plane. I was just skimming through the news feed while we were waiting to board, and I saw this, and I went, "Oh my God, this is absolutely something we need to talk about on the show." So. As we talked about a couple of shows ago, I don't remember, we talked about that, now the anti-gun Democrats are in power, and what do? Clearly, they start launching gun control. The Senate has their super crazy assault weapons ban that is any features is bad features, and any equipment that deletes a feature from a gun that would otherwise have a feature in and itself is a bad feature. So
it's a loophole.
Yes. Compliance with the law is now just a loophole and is an illegal activity. So yeah, good for you, Nancy Pelosi. Thank you so much. You're a sweet, sweet woman. But on the House side, we have the universal background check that we covered ad nauseum on several shows because everyone was pointing out like how many commonplace things people are going to become felons for because you're exchanging a gun for a perfectly lawful and common occurrence. And now that is a felony. You need to go to a gun shop to hand a ranch hand a rifle to shoot coyotes that are harassing the livestock or shoot woodchucks in the field. Like, it's just garbage. And since this is in the House, Steve Scalise said there was a hearing on it. He said, "I want to testify. I'm in the House, and I am an honest to God victim of gun violence." He was shot multiple times by a guy with an SKS rifle, who was a anti-Republican person. He specifically was looking to shoot Republicans, and Steve Scalise happened to be the one that caught a bullet, a couple, I believe. And luckily he pulled through. That was a tough go through. And much like what we saw with the Parkland attack, in an area where people, as a general rule, I've seen this all over. If you are anti-gun and then you're a part of a school shooting, you're going to be calling for more gun control. If you were pro-gun and you're a victim of a mass shooting, you're not going to suddenly be. I've never seen anybody that's had their been a victim of violence and that flipped them. It's always amplified their opinion on the issue. So if you are a victim of violent crime, you would go, it's a gun-free zone. You know, we don't enforce the laws we've got. It goes that way. If you're we need to ban more guns. If this person wasn't able to get the gun, this tragedy wouldn't have occurred. And that's just how it goes. And, you know, in Parkland, it seemed like the students at Parkland were fairly split. Like when I was watching the original news coverage of it, where they were just interviewing anybody who they could get a hold of, because nobody knew anything about what had happened at that point in time. So they were just doing anything they could to fill time. And it seemed like, you know, there was the, you know, David Hogg and Emma Gonzalez and all that talking about, we need more gun control. This is, you know, this is horrible and bad. And then we had, since the news dropped them like a bad habit, I can't even remember their names. Who's the gentleman that spoke at GRPC? Do you remember his name off the top of your head?
I do not.
And you know what? I'm gonna leave this in because I'm ashamed that I have forgotten your name. You're a wonderful speaker. I really appreciate what you've done, and I don't know your name because David Hogg was. We're all living and breathing him. He was everywhere. I mean, he was appearing in my home movies, for Christ's sake. Just so much media coverage. And yet anybody that was saying gun control would not have stopped this. This is, you know, police incompetence. This is not enforcing the laws. This is just bad school policies. The news just goes, yep, we don't need you.
Kyle Kashuv.
Thank you.
I may be butchering his name, K-A-S-H-U-V, so it might be Kashuv, but it's probably Kashuv.
Yep, and he was a great speaker, and I advise everyone to Google him and look him up and see if you can find one of his speeches or any of the talks that he's given, because he needs as much press as these people. And that brings me back to Steve Scalise wants to testify on the House on gun control, and the Democrats successfully blocked him. He was not allowed to testify on the background check bill and how that affects him and his expert opinion as someone who is a victim of gun crime, which we have been told is something that needs to be respected. It's an unimpeachable qualification.
Yes, I believe if you're a victim, you need to be listened and believed.
Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to bring this down on the, I want to get it away from the partisan angles. We can talk about the partisan angles, and I've got it linked in the show notes of the Real Clear Politics is the one, which is a right-wing website. And I really liked how it was all written out. It had all the information that I felt is pertinent in the story, but it is a partisan article. But I really wanted to bring it back more to, again, talking about David Hogg and Emma Gonzalez, the gun control people don't care about you. If they don't care about Steve Scalise, if Steve Scalise is chopped liver and just has nothing to say and needs to be suppressed, they're suppressing him not because he's a victim of gun violence or because he's an illegitimate victim of gun violence or whatever. They're suppressing him because he's pro-gun. And the only reason why Michael Bloomberg gave those kids the time of day was because they were anti-gun, and that's all they want. They are using you. And if you are the victim of violent crime and you're speaking out for gun control and all these people are coming for you, they don't care about you. They don't care about what you've been through. If they cared about you and cared about what you'd been through, they would also care about Steve Scalise, or they would care about Kyle
Kashuv.
Yeah, Kashuv. And they would care about them, and they don't. I can't even keep his name straight. I mean, it's how little they care about them. And they've been through it, and yet it's irrelevant. And so I felt that this was such a shining example of how anti-gun politics works in this country that it needed to be spoken about here.
Normally, I introduce the Gun Lovers and Other Strangers segments, but because Weird is a gentleman, he thought he would spare my voice and introduce it. So take it away, Weird.
So David continues his series on the care and maintenance of firearms. Last episode, he talked about equipment to use when cleaning. Now he goes over some of his techniques for cleaning and inspecting his firearms.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. This is the second installment in my series on gun cleaning. In this segment, I'll be taking a look at some differing procedures for cleaning and maintaining firearms. Obviously, in order to clean your firearm, you need to know how to disassemble it properly. If you have the manual, that's a good start, of course. In addition, there are a variety of online resources, both video and text, for most firearms. Once you have it disassembled into its component pieces, also known as field stripped, the cleaning process can begin. I'll go through my process for each main type of firearm, starting with semi-automatic handguns. After field stripping, run a patch wetted with a preferred solvent back and forth through the bore a couple of times, and set the barrel aside. This allows the solvent to start work on softening any carbon buildup. Then start on the frame, paying special attention to the feed ramp and guide rails. Using a small brush, either a military style or dentist giveaway toothbrush, and some solvent, give all the surfaces a good scrubbing. One of the things to look for on the frame is carbon buildup on the feed ramp and around the top of the magazine well. This is where my brass scraper can come in handy. Before putting the frame aside, make sure to clean out the magazine well by using the toothbrush, followed by pushing a larger cloth up from the bottom of the mag well and out the top of the frame. Next is the slide. Here also, pay special attention to the rails, as well as the breech face. If this is a locked breech pistol, look for any peening or wear on the locking surfaces. A good scrubbing with solvent and brush is generally all this part needs. Examine the recoil spring for signs of wear. If it's a free spring, such as in the 1911, compare the current length of this spring to a new one of the same resistance weight. If your recoil spring is captive, such as in a Glock or SIG, look for any cracks on the washers that retains the spring on the guide rod. These things can tell you if the spring is close to needing replacement. After cleaning and wiping down the slide, frame, and any other parts, such as the recoil spring, guide rod, etc., the next step is to complete cleaning the barrel. Using a bore brush, I prefer the bronze bristle type myself, put a few drops of solvent on the brush and start the brush into the chamber. Give it a few twists in the chamber before running it all the way through the barrel. Whenever possible, clean your barrel from breech to muzzle and never reverse the brush inside the barrel. The first, to help protect the barrel crown at the muzzle from being damaged by the cleaning rod, and the second, to prolong the life of the brush. Finish the barrel by running dry patches through until they come out clean, and then a final patch damp with lubricant. At this point, all that's left is reassembly and an action check. With revolvers, the process can be simpler, as disassembly is usually limited to opening the cylinder. On many double-action revolvers, loosening a single screw may allow you to remove the crane and cylinder for easier access. As with the semi-automatic pistol, run a solvent-wetted patch down the barrel as well as into each chamber of the cylinder. Then get to scrubbing. Pay special attention for signs of wear to the recoil shield where the firing pin protrudes, the forcing cone where the bullet enters the barrel, and the top strap right above the forcing cone. Clean the chambers and barrel the same way as described for the semi-auto barrel, wipe everything down, reassemble the cylinder if necessary, and it's done. After the revolver is cleaned and reassembled, check the front of the frame below the barrel for any gap between the frame and the crane. Any gap here can mean the cylinder is out of alignment with the barrel and can lead to spitting bullet fragments and possibly a cracked forcing cone. Rifles have more variety due to the different types, so I'm going to be a bit more general here, but I'll add a few asides for specific actions or components. Start with basic disassembly and run a patch wetted with solvent down the bore as usual. Again, working from chamber to muzzle if possible. If the barrel has to be cleaned from the muzzle, such as with the M1 Garand, use a muzzle guide to help protect the barrel crown. Another option with rifle barrels that can't be cleaned from the chamber is to run a bare cleaning rod down the barrel from the muzzle, attach the patch or brush in the chamber, and pull the rod back through. This also reduces the chance of the rod flexing and rubbing on the rifling. In my previous segment, I mentioned the risk of using oversized patches. A patch that's too big for the caliber can get wedged in the barrel, possibly breaking the patch holder at the same time. This can present a challenging problem in removal. The best option is often to use a corkscrew-like rod attachment to pick out the patch a bit at a time. Under no circumstances should you try to force the patch out with another rod, as this will almost certainly make the problem worse. If it feels like it's taking too much force to get the patch past the chamber, stop and reassess. Once the solvent is soaking into the barrel, clean all the action parts, making sure to get into the nooks and crannies where fouling can hide. While cleaning the bolt, pay special attention to the breech face and locking lugs for signs of wear or peening. This is especially important with heavier recoiling rifles. When checking the bolt face, look for any brass fragments that might keep the extractor or ejector from operating properly. For the AR-15 family of rifles, clean any carbon residue from the tail of the bolt and inside the bolt carrier. Another good use of my brass scraper. Also, check the gas rings on the bolt and the gas key on the carrier for wear. A good test for gas ring wear is to reassemble the bolt and carrier, extend the bolt fully forward, and gently stand the bolt carrier group on the bolt face. If the gas rings allow the bolt carrier to slide down the bolt, it's time to replace the rings. Wear to the gas key is caused by the gas tube being slightly out of alignment and rubbing on one side of the gas key during normal cycling. The solution for this requires adjusting the barrel nut so it allows the gas tube a straighter path into the upper receiver. Clean the magazine tube, box, or well as appropriate to the type of feed system. Finish cleaning the barrel, wipe down all the parts, reassemble, and it's done. Overall, brake open and pump action shotguns are probably the easiest to clean. Semi-automatic shotguns can be more complicated depending on disassembly and reassembly requirements. With most brake open shotguns, disassembly consists of removing the forend, opening the action, and removing the barrel. With pump and many semi-auto shotguns, disassembly involves unscrewing a retention nut from the end of the magazine tube and then removing the barrel. As I mentioned, this can be more complicated, sometimes considerably so. Things to look for in shotguns include loosening of the hinge pin in break-open shotguns, wear to the barrel lockup and magazine springs in repeating shotguns, damage to the firing pin or pins, wear to the firing pin opening or openings in the frame, dents in the relatively thin barrels, plastic wad residue stuck in the barrel, and cracks in the stock. Wooden shotgun stocks are prone to cracking above the wrist where the stock attaches to the frame. Semi-automatic shotguns are also prone to cracking of the forend. Cleaning consists of the usual wet patch down the barrel, cleaning of all the other parts, cleaning the barrel, wiping everything down, and reassembly. Shotgun patch holders and bore brushes require a special adapter to work on rifle-sized rods. If you're going to be cleaning shotguns frequently, I'd recommend getting a dedicated shotgun rod. These are heavier and thicker than rifle rods. That about wraps up this segment. If you have any questions for me or suggestions for future segments, please post them on the Assorted Calibers Podcast Facebook page, and Aaron or Weird will make sure I get them. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
Am I a bad person when he said he also prefers bronze brushes that I kind of went, neener, 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 two against one?
No, you're not a bad person. I mean, you know, you're allowed to be wrong.
I've never used one of the blue bristle brushes, so maybe I should get one.
See, my problem with the bronze brushes is that, yes, they're really good at cleaning the crap off, but then I've got a layer of bronze that I have to wipe off. Mm-hmm. And I have found that with just a little bit more effort with the blue nylon brush, that like 99% of all the stuff comes off, and then I don't have to do the extra effort of cleaning it again. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if it's like some really, really nasty, like surface rust or whatever, okay, yeah, bronze brush comes out. Yep. But for carbon, no, I am perfectly fine with the blue nylon. But, you know, you do you, babe.
I do.
Okay. So you remember last episode, not last week because there wasn't an episode last week, but 2 weeks ago when Weird Fist, that truly awful, kind of like a musical, only without any redeeming features whatsoever segment called Birds and BS? Yeah, it's back. It's back and it's even worse. You know, it's probably a good thing that I'm fried from my trip because it was actually funny. I worry that if I wasn't fried like this, I would have done damage to my sanity listening to it. But that's why we've got Weird. He listens to these things so you don't have to.
So last week, I started fisking this horrible anti-gun animated musical produced by Jordan Roth and starring C-list celebrity Anna Gasteyer. So last week, I ended with them openly saying they want nothing to do with the Second Amendment, and they want to round up all the guns. At least they're honest about it. Most anti-gun lobbyists and politicians think this too, but they lie about it because it's such an unpopular position. Okay, let's dive right into part two of this fisk. And listeners, be warned, this audio was done in the style of musical theater, and it was done badly.
This is why we can't have compromise. I understand you think that hunting's neat, but sometimes our pastimes jeopardize our lives, which matter more than your precious skeet.
Wow. So they're saying they want to repeal the Second Amendment and ban all the guns, and they say we can't have any compromise. I don't think they thought this through, because I think there are very many gun owners who will be welcome to tell these two jackasses to come and take them. Oh, and you gotta love that bit about hunting and skeet shooting. They already said that even sporting guns have to go. Thankfully, the Second Amendment has nothing to do with hunting or sport.
I understand you really had a ball, then one lone wolf went and ruined it all.
As I said last week, we don't deal in collective punishment. If one lone wolf did something bad with their gun, that has nothing to do with me. Punish them and leave me alone. Oh, and note I said punish the person, because the gun did nothing. Also, this is a cherry-picked argument, as they don't want their cars or cell phones taken away when some jerk climbs a pedestrian as they're texting while driving. No, just guns, because it's an agenda item.
And by one, I mean 96 deaths a day.
So even though there are a lot of people who use guns responsibly, the fun we get to have with them isn't worth the destruction they cause?
Exactly.
So that 96 deaths a day is just the 32 to 36,000 deaths by firearms that have been happening every year since I've been keeping track. And as we all know, the bulk of those deaths are suicide. After that, we're looking at urban gang-on-gang violence. So the use of the term lone wolf brings to mind the very rare event of school shootings, when the bulk of the numbers cited are anything but. And of course, there's that, even though most gun owners act responsibly, the horrible actions of a few justifies heavy restrictions. Note that this was artfully framed when talking about hunting and skeet shooting, because that is a reasonable argument. If 30,000 people were dropping dead at football games from tackles or even heat exposure in the stands, that would be a very compelling argument for banning the sport. It's a lot of fun, and it entertains a lot of people and makes billions of dollars. But 30,000 deaths a year is not a small number for fun in what is essentially a cottage industry. But the Second Amendment was not written to protect people who were shooting ducks and deer and having competitions. It was written for us to protect our lives. Be it from the criminal elements of society, to governments, foreign or domestic, looking to oppress us. And while the United States has not been invaded by a foreign government, I will note the disputed quote from Admiral Yamamoto expressing his reluctance for the Imperial Japanese to attempt to conquer the continental United States for fear that there would be a rifle behind every blade of grass. Studies have shown that we indeed do use our guns to protect our lives an awful lot, from over 1 million uses in high estimates to around 100,000 uses every year. I'll note that that low estimate, and I take that number with as much of a grain of salt as the high one, is the exact number of gun injuries, including deaths per year. So at the lowest estimate, our defensive gun uses break even with the number of people being shot. And very likely, that number exceeds it. So really, they're playing a little sleight of hand here. But they're doing it with people's lives. Banning of guns would very likely result in more deaths, not less. But since their goal is banning guns, not public safety, this doesn't concern them.
You know, there's a lot of things we do that with.
Like lawn darts, Sudafed, and adopted animals are harder to get than a gun.
Oh, God. So first up, lawn darts are a game. And while I played the crap out of them as a kid, I really don't miss them. Bocce is way more fun and doesn't put holes in your lawn. The Sudafed argument should piss everybody off as much as their mention of the TSA's no shoes policy. As with the TSA being a huge pain in the rear for near zero benefit to public safety, the national restriction on pseudoephedrine, which is a precursor to the drug crystal meth, has done nothing to reduce meth addiction in this country. And many have argued it has actually made it worse. Kind of like gun control. And adopting a pet having less restrictions than buying a gun? Since when do we not let convicted felons or misdemeanor domestic offenders have pets? This is utter crap. I assume they're playing games in that you might have a background check of some sort if you attempt to adopt a pet from a shelter. But it isn't as extensive as the background check you get from a gun shop.
Oh, but you can buy a gun at a gun show. No questions asked.
Well, first, no, you can't. But even if that was the case, there is nothing stopping somebody from just giving their pet to somebody else. So their analogy here is just as bad as every other analogy they've made so far.
A gun beneath your pillow makes you feel secure. Till you think your granny's a burglar, then it loses its allure. They say a good guy with a gun could could stop a bad guy with a gun.
But neither has to die if neither one has won.
Okay, this is just solid crap. So in case you couldn't make out the words in Anna Gasteyer's best impersonation of a cat being strangled, she is saying you might not want your gun once you shoot your grandmother when you mistake her for an intruder. They're citing the Kellerman study. And if you've been following the Gun Blog Variety Cast, you know how much crap the study is. I have a link in the show notes about GBVC episode 160 where I tear all the problems with this show to shreds. But besides citing a garbage study, they're citing it incorrectly. In a very lame defense, this is one of the most common misconceptions of what Kellerman's study actually found. The Kellerman study simply stated that suicides by guns were vastly more common in homes where guns were owned. Duh. And when someone was killed in the home, they were more likely to be known to the killer than it'd be a total stranger. Given that Kellerman only sampled several high-crime urban areas, most of those killings were criminals killing other criminals. So of course they knew each other. So the premise that you'll be shooting a family member by mistake is very unlikely. As for good guys stopping bad guys with guns, think about any bad guy being stopped. Who's doing it? A good guy with a gun in almost all cases. The defense rests. Hey, but if we take away the guns from both the cops and the robbers, they'll be left with no other options but singing songs and making friendship bracelets. Never mind all those nations that have epidemics of machete crime.
I only wonder how these men will find their sense of self-worth and masculinity without their pew pew.
Yep, that's just a great argument to make. Us gunnies only want guns to make us feel more manly. And you wonder why this video has more downvotes than actual subscribers.
We are, as a country, should be safe for everyone. Australians stay butch after their overhaul.
So if you're a macho prick, you can stay one after all.
We're worried that if gun banners will win, we'll just become a nation of soy boys or something. Except Australia and the UK saw a rise in violent crime after their gun ban. But of course, they've been avoiding any mention of personal protection this whole video. So why stop now?
This is why we can't have Rambo teachers.
You mean armed school teachers? Why not? Has there been any school shootings in schools where the teachers or students could be lawfully armed?
And when the government needs to be overthrown, get your ass out and vote, because we can do this alone.
What? This is literally the dumbest thing they have said in this whole stupid video. I never much cared for President Obama. I don't much care for President Trump. Does that mean the government needs to be overthrown? Of course not. Since we still have free and honest elections, we don't need to. Governments that need to be overthrown are the ones that have completely cut the citizenry out of the power structure of government. Horrible human rights hellholes like China, North Korea, Venezuela, and Russia all have autocracies. And if the people don't like it, they could pound sand or overthrow the government, which would be tricky given all these autocracies, dictatorships, and juntas have all banned the private ownerships of firearms. Funny how that works.
This is why we can't have the Electoral College.
So they say they want to take away all the guns because you can vote away any problems, and then they declare a mob rules method of voting that would make all but the inhabitants of the top few urban centers obsolete in elections. You live in northern New England, you live in the Great Plains, you live in Appalachia, any place you could see the stars at night. Well, congratulations, you are now simply the spectator to the elections. Oh, and turning your guns, because you can't have nice things. Yeah, that sounds like a wise move. Those are your anti-gun talking points and a few rebuttals to combat them. I swear next week, Aaron, it's not going to be flamboyant anti-gun homosexuals.
I think I've said this before, but what I think we need is some sort of flamboyant pro-gun homosexual. And again, you know, the Gay for Gun podcast. And just completely camp it up. Okay, I'm sure some people would be butthurt and find it offensive. But just, okay, here's actually what I'm thinking. In Living Color, do you remember Men on Film?
Yes.
Okay, I'm thinking like... Okay, maybe not that level because that was obviously satire, but just something like that where it's like, yes, I yes, I am a homosexual, and I'm just completely gay for these guns, and they are fabulous. And I want someone to be sincere. I don't want it to be a joke. I want it to be campy, but not a joke, if you understand what that means. And just completely, oh my God, this gun is just so fabulous, and it comes in all these different colors, and it's just really cool. That's what I want.
What brings to mind was the late, great, wonderful Ray Carter of the Second Amendment Foundation, and he was a Pink Pistols chapter president. I remember seeing him with a Dennis from Dragon Leatherworks. He made him a rainbow colored, and I think he put a unicorn horn on it, holster for his Smith & Wesson 625 mountain gun in 45 Colt. And seeing him walk around, he wasn't a totally butch gay guy, but he wasn't flamboyant either, but he definitely could get there. And his love of that holster and just parading around with that gorgeous revolver in that fabulous holster is, I think, exactly what you were looking for.
I never saw it happen, but I remember a story where Ray apparently went full-on high queen at some sort of demonstration of anti-gunners. And I wish I could remember the story or link you to it, but he just went full-on fabulous, flamboyant, and... Oh, honey, no! You know that level of things.
Oh,
and
yeah, he could turn it up to 11.
And apparently the people there were just dying paroxysms of laughter.
So we have a Facebook group, and in this group,
do we? Weird, really?
Yes.
I honestly had no idea. That's a shock to me. We have a Facebook group. Wow.
Yeah.
And you so tell me more about this group.
In this group, you could talk to every member of the ACP staff.
Wow. Like you and me?
Like you and me.
Wow. What can people do in this group?
You can ask us questions. You can make fun of us. And you can also request topics for future segments. And
wow.
And one of those people in that group is Xander. We love Xander. He's awesome. And he asked the ACP House Dick a great question about a PI and what they should know. And Steve made a whole segment on it.
Good morning, everybody. It's your friendly neighborhood trunk monkey, Steve, back with another episode for ACP. Now, conveniently, one of our faithful listeners, Xander, he had a question. So if you aren't a part of the Facebook group, you should join. You should join in. Contribute. You can get directly in touch with ACP contributors. You can ask questions, poke fun, and generally have a good time with us crazy bunch of people. Now, I'm going to just jump right into Xander's question, which was this. How much does a PI have to know about a medical condition that one is verifying, or is it a matter of subject is reported unable to do X, suspicion of doing X, please verify activity? The shortest, most brief answer is, I don't need to know squat. The slightly longer answer is, I'm basically paid to observe and report. And while technically I'm party to the plaintiff, you know, insurance, megacorp, you know, Omni Insurance, whatever, I function as technically a disinterested third party. Now, in approximately 90% of my insurance fraud cases, I have a known injury and a list of restrictions that the subject of my investigation has been instructed to follow as part of their recovery or continued disability. My job is to not get technical to any degree, because cross-examination sucks, and I'm not a biomechanical engineer or a physician. So, take for example, individual A. He's a middle-aged male, average build, worked for one of the big three at a plant, putting widgets onto various gizmos. He suffers an on-the-job injury to, let's say, his right arm. He's been off work now for 3, maybe 4 months, attending physical therapy sporadically according to client billing. His restriction is no work. No lifting of objects with his right hand or arm over 5 pounds, no repetitive motion, twisting, etc. Insurance company says at the end of 3 months he should have reached MMR, which is maximum medical recovery, for his non-surgical sprain, strain, whatever. He is still, of course, drawing benefits and has not worked since the date of loss. And he is still obviously being paid. He's been offered light duty back at his employer, but has refused, saying he needs surgery and not just PT. An insurance company calls me up and says, okay, we have a file for you. We need 5 days of surveillance, with 1 day being before a scheduled appointment with a third-party medical facility to provide an independent medical assessment. The day of said appointment at X location, and then the day after. Two other days can be used once you develop your own profile to see what the individual's daily activities might be. You'll be given more money if you find more information that could be pertinent to our file, which means, you know, more days of surveillance. So, I run a profile on the information provided. I find social media. I find, you know, family, friends, vehicles, yada, 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 yada. I set up on the first day, and during the surveillance, this individual goes grocery shopping with the wife to the local warehouse club. Remember his 5-pound restriction? He's shopping. He's lifting and placing things like gallons of milk into a cart, loading 40-pound bags of dog food, etc., and then he goes home. Okay, nothing out of the ordinary for anybody else, right? Except for the injury, of course. We have repetitive motion, we have weight restriction violations, so I'll to count out how many gallons of milk that he moves. And how big the bag of dog food is. But that's generally it. It's all good stuff, and objectively speaking, his claim could be questioned by the adjuster and counsel when they receive my report. The next day that I happen to work him, he happens to go to the gym. I buy a day pass, and I shadow the guy's workout for 2 hours. I grab covert video of the individual bench pressing considerable weight, doing assorted upper body workouts such as chest flies, rowing. You know, I overhear a conversation with a trainer that he'd be in for his usual class later in the week. I make a note, and I return to my car. I package this all up neatly for the client, and this is, you know, without even getting to the medical appointment, which he, you know, he may show up and put on a good show with a brace or a sling, stuff like that. I just provide a factual accounting of what was documented on those particular days. The adjuster and the attorneys then go from there, make their assessment, and make their counterclaim. So I just provide what I see. Because as far as I'm concerned, if it wasn't on video, it didn't happen, and it just becomes a game of he said, she said, which of course is something you generally don't want to get into. So, you know, I say if the individual, you know, had an injury to their leg, I don't say a normal gait. I just say the claimant walked. Or they used a walker with wheels or a cane with a 4-pronged foot, you know, with tennis balls for traction. You remember the biomechanical engineer that I mentioned really early, just a minute or two ago, right? The reason I mentioned that is this in particular. I happened to sit in on a case that went to trial in Detroit about 2 years ago. Where the individual being surveilled had managed to get one of the big-name local attorneys to take his case. I won't get into the details there because that'd be another episode entirely. And this particular attorney is well-known in the Detroit area. Those guys, you know, we have guys like Figer, Sam Bernstein, Mike Morris, Ben Johnson. So if you're from the region, you know those names. I'm sure, you know, various listeners have big name, you know, injury attorneys, you know, that fight the insurance company for the little guy and no fee unless you win. So the guy is absolutely no slouch and he absolutely knows his stuff. And he happened to hire, for his client's defense, an out of state biomechanical engineer that's published in a dozen journals and yada, yada, yada. To the tune of $900 a day for expert testimony over the 3 or 4 days of her testimony, which was actually rather interesting. And it secured his client a judgment to the tune of $20 million. That's $1 million. The insurance company, of course, was absolutely savaged. I don't know what the deal was with the insurance company's team of lawyers, but I mean, they absolutely got trounced. Me personally, I dislike cross-examination. My expert testimony, which has settled a handful of cases, both in the millions of dollars ranges to, you know, regular lesser amounts, going to positive conclusions are generally what I deal with. And my testimony as an expert witness in many of these cases consists of the following. Yes, this is my report. Yes, this is my video. I took it on these certain days, and the defendant observed over there is the individual being observed in this video. Now, more often than not, especially within the last, I'd say, 4 or 5 years, cases of just about any value or exposure level are handled now in mediation. Because as we all know, the wheels of justice turn very slowly. Mediation moves just a smidge faster. Most insurance companies are willing to write off five-digit claims just to be rid of certain individuals. I'm lucky if I see the inside of a courtroom maybe once, maybe twice a year. I'll attend mediation hearing maybe once or twice every quarter. That's just the nature of the beast and efficiency at this point. You know, insurance companies do have rather large bottom lines. However, you know, nobody likes to sit there and write giant checks to assholes. So that's why they bring me in. And that, of course, is part of the reason in insurance is so expensive nowadays. Not only do they have to pay off those claims that they feel they just can't win, or they're just no longer willing to take the risk, and then they got to hire somebody like me. So I hope that answers your question. You know, maybe it brings up more. So if you like, guys, you know, feel free to hit me up in the Facebook group. Find me on Facebook in general. Yell at our lovely hosts, Weird and Aaron. But otherwise, I'll catch you guys on the flip side. So, as always, stay ninja.
Alright, so what I'm getting from this is, well, okay, he's a trunk monkey. He's a trained monkey. He really doesn't need to know anything other than, go here, take pictures.
Mm-hmm. And also, I also like the fact that there's reasons for that. Don't go too far. He's there to collect evidence, and the more impartial the evidence, the better it is, and if he does, yeah, make a mistake in saying that, oh, it looked like they were favoring the other leg, or they were putting too much weight on the other leg, that's something that could be shot up. Instead, just take pictures. Just take pictures. I got to know, Steve, for a future segment, like the bit about swinging by the gym and buying a day pass. All right, first up, Steve's posted pictures of him wearing rollers. I think it's him wearing roller skates. Somebody wearing roller skates. So I need to know about this, because it sounds like a great 80s movie that was never made. But I want to know, like, does he have, like, in the back of the ninja wagon, does he have his workout clothes so that he can suddenly show up at a Planet Fitness at the top of a hat and not look out of place versus, you know, being at the squat rack wearing a tank top, a pair of jeans, and his Operation Blazing Sword holster?
For some reason, I envisioned him wearing a tank top, but with the midriff ripped off. It was in some sort of vibrant lemon yellow, and then spandex bike shorts in kind of a neon green and orange.
Oh, that is altogether too attractive. Steve, don't do that. It'll be dangerous to members of all sexes. All the genders and all the gender fluids will just be like, yeah, that's hot. Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcalibrespodcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus content like our hilarious blooper reels, the ACP film tracks, and the ACP mag dump.
You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com, and hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
You know, just go to facebook.com/Aaron.Pellet. That's where I am. You can find all my stuff there. I paste all my stuff there because I am a gigantic internet slut. And I want everyone to read my stuff, and that's my portal. So, yeah, go there, read me, comment. I've got a really awesome picture of me, the International Lord of Hate. Yep.
It's an awesome picture.
It is. It's so awesome.
And speaking of awesome, Nate Spencer made our awesome music.
Yeah, I don't know. So what? It's like 25 degrees, feels like 12. You've got massive wind chill up where you are. And for me, it's, I don't know, 63 degrees and 70% humidity. So clearly our climates are assorted, and so is our podcast. I don't know. I'm tired. I want to go to bed. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Sleep tight, Aaron.